This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Good evening. My name is Avi Lewis, and I'm here to welcome all of you to the latest installment in the ever-evolving orgy of intellectual and spiritual stimulation known as the Lannan Readings and Conversations series here at the legendary Lenzik Performing Arts Center. That's right. I can tell we have some repeat revelers in the audience. What a marvelous thing you have here. As if we, from the outside, needed another reason to be jealous of Santa Fe. Thank you very much. You know you're spoiled in this community by so many things, but above all, in my view, by the epic curiosity, by the creative restlessness, and the generosity of the Lannan family and the Lannan Foundation, who seem determined to feed your minds a rich and complex diet in the midst of an all-you-can-eat culture saturated with high-fructose reality syrup. So as we enjoy the anticipation of Arundhati Roy speaking from this podium in mere minutes, I'd like to thank the Lannan Foundation for this evening, for this series, and for the commitment it has shown over many years to supporting the bravest artists and activists from around the world. And without indulging the vague smugness of Santa Feans any further, we are also allowed to participate via the excellent podcasts in which I have indulged much over the last few days, especially. Arundhati Roy has been honored here before with the Cultural Freedom Prize in 2002. She began her now famous lecture come September on this stage, almost 8 years ago, by talking about her experience of writing, of its necessity, its imperative. She said that stories, and I'm quoting here, stories insist on being told. Fiction and nonfiction are only different techniques of storytelling. For reasons that I don't fully understand, fiction dances out of me and nonfiction is wrenched out by the aching, broken world I wake up to every morning. Now, as much as that's the Arundhati, You feel it every time you get an email message with a quote from Arundhati as the signature at the end. You've seen those. But as much as her spectacular sculpting of sentences, it's that kind of urgency, a kind of poetic political possession that makes Arundhati such a powerful writer and thinker. What I want to do in just a very few minutes, very briefly, is share some of the other qualities of her work that I have personally been most grateful for over the years. For all of her poetry, for her scathing grace on the page, she's a relentlessly logical thinker. She looks at the injustice of the aching, broken world, at the hypocrisy and the corruption of the official narratives, and simply doesn't let anyone off the hook, including herself. For this reason, Arundhati has a history of piercing the comfort of those who consider themselves progressive. The momentum of her laser-guided arguments takes her beyond what is culturally safe into the dangerous territory of logical conclusions. In 2001, you will remember, long before that decade's anti-war movement had gathered steam, she called the U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan an act of terror against the people of the world. In 2004, when the... And I think some people weren't entirely ready. In 2004, when the anti-war movement was strong, but in some countries, which will remain unnamed, was very parochial, she said that the Iraqi resistance was fighting on the front lines of empire and that it deserved support. A line that almost never got a round of applause in non-overtly socialist gatherings. In her latest book, Field Notes on Democracy, she dares to ask whether the fusion of liberal electoral democracy and corporate capitalism will turn out to be the end game for the human race. In other words, Arundhati doesn't push envelopes, she shreds them. She gets in hot water. She never apologizes. She has no respect for comfort zones. And while this irritating habit of her moral consistency often gets her called a polemicist, I think, in my view, that's utterly wrong. She is, in fact, preoccupied with the very old-fashioned notion that facts matter, that precision and accuracy are necessary tools in the work of patiently deconstructing a system that has, among its many other indignities, ripped language of its meaning. In fact, her commitment to correcting the official story with facts and sources and names and dates, in doing that, she worries in her latest work that she has become a clerk of resistance. If that's the case, perhaps you will join me tonight in letting Arundhati know that clerking has suddenly become an incredibly appealing line of work. Where do I apply? Finally, in the last few years, whether intentionally or not, she has insisted that her huge international audience pay attention to what's going on in her own country, that place that likes to be known by its registered trademark, the world's biggest democracy. By writing almost exclusively about India, its operatic political narratives, its mass slaughters, its military occupations, its resistance movements, she has done invaluable, if thankless, work in the long project of filling in the gaping chasms in our knowledge of the world outside of this superpower. Today, I listened to the podcast of Arundhati's last appearance here in 2002. Her interlocutor that night, and I don't know if anyone here was there, was Howard Zinn, whose warm, radical, clarion voice was lost to us this year. As their conversation drew to a close, they were talking about the rise of fascist Hindu nationalism and the horrific massacre of Muslims in Gujarat just months before that event, which was a significant turning point in the history of the region. Howard, in his lovely, wide-open way, confessed that if Arundhati had not written about that mass crime, he would never have known anything about it. They talked about the value of this kind of globalization, a people's globalization, sharing stories across borders. Howard shared his image vision of the world in which people are divided by chalk lines, and the two of them quickly agreed that their job was to rub them out. And then Arundhati ended the evening by reading from an essay published some years before. In it, she describes a conversation with a world-weary friend who suggests to her that with all the fame and adulation and notoriety that gushed into her life in the wake of her first novel, the rest of her days were going to pale in comparison. The friend argues that the only perfect ending for her story is for the writer to die at the peak of her success, the literary equivalent of the rock and roll suicide. Arundhati tries to explain that she lives in another world, one governed by an entirely different set of values. She says, "The only dream worth having is to dream that you will live while you are alive and die only when you're dead." In a way, she tries to articulate the value of a life in struggle. So the final passage that she read is classic Arundhati, but reading it today, it struck me that it's also a powerful eulogy for Howard, and not to mention a goal for all of us who aspire to be useful in a broken and aching world. So let the last words from that evening be the invocation for what we share here tonight. What does it mean to live while you're alive and die only when you're dead? This is what Arundhati wrote. To love, to be loved, to never forget your own insignificance, to never get used to the unspeakable violence and the vulgar disparity of life around you, to seek joy in the saddest places, to pursue beauty to its lair, to never simplify what is complicated or complicate what is simple, to respect strength, never power, above all, to watch, to try and understand, to never look away, and never, never to forget. Ladies and gentlemen, Arundhati Roy.
Thank you for that, Avi, and thank you all for being here. It's lovely to be back, 7 years on, 7 years older, but still around, all of us. What can I say about the Lannan Foundation, except that, you know, some of us, Avi, me, Naomi, Anthony Arnov, all of us are prickly and difficult customers, and would be very, very, very wary of accepting an alliance with any foundation. And the fact that we come again and again and again to speak at this place, the Lannan Foundation, says a lot for the kind of politics that it espouses. So thank you very much for keeping the flag flying in the belly of the beast. I really do want to say that you know, just being here makes me really miss Howard Zinn, who grew to be such a close friend. And the last time I was here, obviously, he was here. And I've just come out of spending 3 weeks in the forests of central India with a guerrilla army. And they have no phones, no internet, no nothing, you know, but they have a little computer. And on it, they watched the talk I gave here. So I saw this auditorium in the middle of the jungle in central India just a few weeks ago. So I'm going to read from my new book, Field Notes on Democracy, Listening to Grasshoppers. As Avi said, it is a book which is a collection of writing about the world's biggest democracy, which is one of the largest public relations scam in the 20th and 21st centuries, like yours. watching what happens there very carefully, watching how each of the institutions that are supposed to make up a democracy function, I began to question what's happened to democracy. So I'm going to read, and I'm sorry if some of you will be a little bit unfamiliar with what I'm saying, but obviously each of the essays in this book details that out. But when I was in school, I once raided the vegetable patch of my Malayalam teacher and stole all the carrots and planted the tops back. And I watched him water those plants for a long time. And that's what seems to have happened. You know, each of these institutions that make up a democracy have been sort of hollowed out, and we've planted the shells back, and we keep watering them and wondering why they continue to wilt. So I'm going to read from Democracy's Failing Light. While we're still arguing about whether there's life after death, can we add another question to the cart? Is there life after democracy? What sort of life will it be? By democracy, I don't mean democracy as an ideal or an aspiration. I mean the working model, Western liberal democracy and its variants such as they are. So is there life after democracy? Attempts to answer this question often turn into a comparison of different systems of governance and end with the somewhat prickly combative defense of democracy. It's flawed, we say. It isn't perfect, but it's better than everything else that's on offer. Inevitably, someone in the room will say, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Somalia. Is that what you would prefer? Whether democracy should be the utopia that all developing societies aspire to is a separate question altogether. I think it should, because the early idealistic phase can be quite heady. But the question about life after democracy is addressed to those of us who already live in democracies or in countries that pretend to be democracies. It isn't meant to suggest that we lapse into older, discredited models of totalitarian or authoritarian governance. It's meant to suggest that the system of representative democracy, too much representation, too little democracy, needs some structural adjustment. The question here really is, what have we done to democracy? What have we turned it into? What happens once democracy has been used up? When it has been hollowed out and emptied of meaning? What happens when each of its institutions has metastasized into something dangerous? What happens now that democracy and the free market have fused into a single predatory organism with a thin, constricted imagination that revolves almost entirely around the idea of maximizing profit? Is it possible to reverse this process? Can something that has mutated go back to being what it used to be? What we need today for the sake of the survival of this planet is long-term vision. Can governments whose very survival depends on immediate, extractive, short-term gain provide this? Could it be that democracy, the sacred answer to our short-term hopes and prayers, the protector of our individual freedoms and nurturer of our avaricious dreams, will turn out to be the end game for the human race? Could it be that democracy is such a hit with modern humans, precisely because it mirrors our greatest folly, our nearsightedness, our inability to live entirely in the present, like most animals do, combined with our inability to see very far into the future, makes us strange in-between creatures, neither beast nor prophet? Our amazing intelligence seems to have outstripped our instinct for survival. We plunder the earth, hoping that accumulating material surplus will make up for the profound, unfathomable thing that we have lost. As a writer, a fiction writer, I've often wondered whether the attempt to always be precise, to try and get it all factually right, somehow reduces the epic scale of what's really going on. Does it eventually mask a larger truth? I worry that I'm allowing myself to be railroaded into offering prosaic factual precision when maybe what we need is a feral howl or the transformative power and the real precision of poetry. But something about the cunning, Brahmanical, intricate, bureaucratic, file-bound, applied through proper channels nature of governance and subjugation in India seems to have made a clerk out of me. My only excuse is to say that it takes odd tools to uncover the maze of subterfuge and hypocrisy that cloaks the callousness and the cold, calculated violence of the world's favorite new superpower. Repression through proper channels sometimes engenders resistance through proper channels. As resistance goes, this isn't enough, I know. But for now, it's all I have. Perhaps someday it will become the underpinning for poetry and for the feral howl. Listening to Grasshoppers, the essay from which this collection draws its subtitle, was a lecture I gave in Istanbul in January 2008 on the first anniversary of the assassination of the Armenian journalist Harant Dink. He was shot down on the street outside his office for daring to raise a subject that is forbidden in Turkey, the 1915 genocide of Armenians, in which more than 1 million people were killed. My lecture was about the history of genocide and genocide denial and the old, almost organic relationship between progress and genocide. I've always been struck by the fact that the political party in Turkey that carried out the Armenian genocide was called the Committee for Union and Progress. Most of the essays in this collection are, in fact, about the contemporary correlation between union and progress, or in today's idiom, between nationalism and development, those unimpeachable twin towers of modern free market democracy. Both of these, in their extreme form, are, as we know now, encrypted with the potential of bringing about ultimate apocalyptic destruction, nuclear war or climate change. In this book, the invisible marker, the starting gun, is the year 1989. Basically, in 1989, in India, two things happened. When capitalism won its jihad in the rugged mountains of Afghanistan and buried Soviet communism. In India, two things happened. One was, it's like two locks were opened. One was the lock of the market. Suddenly it became a free market. And the other was a lock of an old 17th century mosque called the Babri Masjid. And the Hindu right began to campaign saying this mosque should be demolished and we should build a temple there because it's the birthplace of Ram. So when these two locks were opened, two kinds of totalitarianism were released. One was economic totalitarianism, the free market, and the other was religious totalitarianism, which became very, very serious, as you'll hear. So in 1989, in the rugged mountains of Afghanistan, capitalism won its long jihad against Soviet communism. Of course, the wheels and spin again. Could it be that those same mountains are now in the process of burying capitalism? It's too early to tell. But within months of the collapse of the Soviet Union and the fall of the Berlin Wall, the Indian government, once a leader of the non-aligned movement, performed a high-speed somersault and aligned itself completely with the United States, monarch of the new unipolar world. The rules of the game changed suddenly and completely. Millions of people who lived in remote villages and deep in the heart of untouched forests, some of whom had never heard of Berlin or the Soviet Union, could not have imagined how events that occurred in those faraway places would affect their lives. The process of their dispossession and displacement had already begun in the early 1950s, when India opted for the Soviet-style development model, in which huge steel plants and large dams would occupy the commanding heights of the economy. But the era of privatization and structural adjustment accelerated that process at a mind-numbing speed. Today, words like progress and development have become interchangeable with economic reforms, deregulation, and privatization. Freedom has come to mean choice. It has less to do with the human spirit than with different brands of deodorant. Market no longer means a place where you buy provisions. The market is a deterritorialized space where faceless corporations do business, including buying and selling futures. Justice has come to mean human rights, and of those, as they say, a few will do. This theft of language, this technique of usurping words and deploying them like weapons, of using them to mask intent and to mean exactly the opposite of what they've traditionally meant, has been one of the most brilliant strategic victories of the czars of the new dispensation. It's allowed them to marginalize their detractors, deprive them of a language to voice their critique, and dismiss them as being anti-progress, anti-development, anti-reform, and of course, anti-national, negativists of the worst sort. Talk about saving a river or protecting a forest, and they say, "Don't you believe in progress?" To people whose land is being submerged by dam reservoirs and whose homes are being bulldozed, they say, "Do you have an alternative development model?" To those who believe that a government is duty-bound to provide people with basic education, health care, and social security, they say, "You're against the market." And who except a cretin could be against markets? To reclaim these stolen words requires explanations that are too tedious for a world with a short attention span and too expensive in an era when free speech has become unaffordable for the poor. This language heist may prove to be the keystone of our undoing. 2 decades of this kind of progress in India has created a vast middle class punched drunk on sudden wealth and the sudden respect that comes with it, and a much, much vaster, desperate underclass. Tens of millions of people have been dispossessed and displaced from their land by floods, drought, and desertification caused by indiscriminate environmental engineering, and massive infrastructural projects, dams, mines, and special economic zones, all developed in the name of the poor, but really meant to service the rising demands of the new aristocracy. The battle for land in India lies at the heart of the development debate. Before he became India's finance minister, P. Chidambaram was Enron's lawyer and member of the board of directors of Vedanta, a multinational mining corporation that's currently devastating the Niyamgiri Hills in Orissa. Perhaps his career graph informed his worldview, or maybe it's the other way around. But in an interview a year ago, he said that his vision was to get 85% of India's population to live in cities. That process is well underway and is quickly turning India into a police state in which people who refuse to surrender their lands are being made to do so at gunpoint. Perhaps this is what makes it so easy for P. Chidambaram to move so seamlessly from being finance minister to being home minister. Basically, it would mean moving 500 million people off their lands, a project of social engineering that you can't even imagine. The portfolios are separated only by an osmotic membrane. Underlying this nightmare masquerading as vision is the plan to free up vast tracts of land and all of India's natural resources, leaving them ripe for corporate plunder. In effect, to reverse the post-independence policy of land reform. Already, forests, mountains, and water systems are being ravaged by marauding multinational corporations backed by a state that has lost its moorings and is committing what can only be called ecocide. In eastern India, bauxite and iron ore mining is destroying whole ecosystems, turning fertile land into desert. In the Himalayas, hundreds of high dams are being planned, the consequences of which can only be catastrophic. In the plains, embankments built along rivers ostensibly to control floods have led to rising riverbeds, causing even more flooding, more waterlogging, more salinization of agricultural land, and the destruction of livelihoods of millions of people. Most of India's holy rivers, including the Ganga, have been turned into unholy drains that carry more sewage and industrial effluent than water. Hardly a single river runs its course and meets the ocean. But based on the absurd notion that a river flowing into the sea is a waste of water, the Supreme Court, in an act of unbelievable hubris, has arbitrarily ordered that India's rivers be interlinked like a mechanical water supply system. Implementing this would mean tunneling through mountains and forests, altering natural contours and draining systems of river basins, and destroying deltas and estuaries. In other words, wrecking the ecology of the entire subcontinent. B.N. Kirpal, the judge who passed this order, joined the environmental board of Coca-Cola after he retired. Nice touch. The regime of free market economic policies administered by people who are blissfully ignorant of the fate of civilizations that grew too dependent on artificial irrigation has led to a worrying shift in cropping patterns. Sustainable food crops suitable to local soil conditions and microclimates have been replaced by water-guzzling, hybrid, genetically modified cash crops, which, apart from being wholly dependent on the market, are also heavily dependent on chemical fertilizers, pesticides, canal irrigation, and the indiscriminate mining of groundwater. As abused farmland, saturated with chemicals, gradually becomes exhausted and infertile, agricultural input costs rise, ensnaring small farmers in a debt trap. Over the last few years, more than 180,000 Indian farmers have committed suicide. And of course, they are much more comfortable with that than suicide bombers. They like people to commit suicide you know, quietly. While state granaries are bursting with food that eventually rots, starvation and malnutrition approaching the same levels as sub-Saharan Africa stalk the land. Truly, the 9% growth rate is beginning to look like a downward spiral. The higher the rate of this kind of growth, the worse the prognosis. Any oncologist will tell you that. It's as though an ancient society, decaying under the weight of feudalism and caste, was churned in a great machine. The churning has ripped through the mesh of old equalities, recalibrating some of them, but reinforcing most. And now the old society has curdled and separated into a thin layer of thick cream and a lot of water. The cream is India's market of many million consumers, of cars and cell phones, computers, and Valentine's Day greeting cards, the envy of international business. The water is of little consequence. It can be sloshed around, stored in holding ponds, and eventually drained away. Or so they think. They didn't bargain for the violent civil war that has broken out in India's heartland, Chhattisgarh, Jharkhand, Orissa, West Bengal. So now there's an openly declared war against the indigenous people of India called Operation Green Hunt, which I'll talk about, I suppose, with Avi later. But coming back to 1989, as if to illustrate the connection between union and progress, at exactly the same time that the Congress government was opening up India's market to international finance, the right-wing Bharatiya Janata Party, the BJP, then in opposition, began its virulent campaign of Hindu nationalism, popularly known as Hindutva. In 1990, its leader, L.K. Advani, traveled across the country whipping up hatred against Muslims and demanding that the Babri Masjid be demolished and a Ram temple be built in its place. The BJP's run by a sort of cultural guild called the RSS, which was set up in 1925, and I just want to read a few excerpts from the RSS Bible, which is called We or Our Nationhood Defined by M.S. Golwalkar. Ever since that evil day when Muslims first landed in Hindustan, right up to the present moment, the Hindu nation has been gallantly fighting on to take on these despoilers. The race spirit has been awakening. And then, in Hindustan, the land of the Hindus, lives and should live the Hindu nation. All others are traitors and enemies to the national cause, or, to take a charitable view, idiots. The foreign races in Hindustan may stay in the country wholly subordinated to the Hindu nation, claiming nothing, deserving no privileges, far less any preferential treatment, not even citizens' rights. To keep up the purity of its race and culture, Germany shocked the world by her purging the country of the Semitic races, the Jews. Race pride at its highest has been manifested here, a good lesson for us in Hindustan to learn and profit by. By the year 2000, the RSS had more than 60,000 branches and an army of more than 4 million volunteers preaching its doctrine. They include India's former Prime Minister, Atal Bihari Vajpayee, the former Home Minister and current leader of the opposition, L.K. Advani, and of course, he just resigned, and of course, the three-time Gujarat Chief Minister, Narendra Modi. So this was the BJP coming to power after 1989. In 92, a mob egged on by Advani demolished the mosque. In early 93, a mob rampaged through Mumbai, attacking Muslims, killing almost 1,000 people. As revenge, a series of bomb blasts ripped through the city, killing about 250 people. And feeding off the communal frenzy it had generated, the BJP, which had only 2 seats in parliament in 1984, defeated the Congress and came to power in 1998. It's not a coincidence that the rise of Hindutva corresponded with the historical moment when the United States substituted communism with Islam as its great enemy. The radical Islamist Mujahideen, who President Reagan once entertained at the White House and compared to America's founding fathers, suddenly began to be called terrorists. CNN's live broadcast of the 1990 Gulf War, Operation Desert Storm, made it to elite drawing rooms in Indian cities, bringing with it the early thrills of satellite TV. Almost simultaneously, the Indian government, once a staunch friend of the Palestinians, turned into Israel's natural ally. Now India and Israel do joint military exercises, share intelligence, and probably exchange notes on how best to administer occupied territories. There's a lot of trade, by the way, between Zionists and the Hindu right. Within weeks of taking office, the BJP conducted a series of thermonuclear tests. And though India had thrown its hat into the nuclear ring in 1975, politically, the 1998 nuclear tests were of a different order altogether. The orgy of triumphant nationalism with which the tests were greeted introduced a chilling new language of aggression and hatred into mainstream public discourse. None of what was being said was new. It's just that what was once considered unacceptable was suddenly being celebrated. Since then, Hindu communalism and nuclear nationalism, like corporate globalization, have vaulted over the stated ideologies of political parties, and the venom has been injected straight into our bloodstream. It's there now in all its violence and banality for us to deal with in our daily lives, regardless of whether the government at the center calls itself secular or not. The Muslim community has seen a sharp decline in its fortunes and is now at the bottom of the social pyramid, along with Dalits and tribal people. In February 2002, following the burning of a train coach in which 58 Hindu pilgrims returning from Ayodhya were burnt alive, the BJP government in Gujarat, led by Chief Minister Narendra Modi, presided over a carefully planned genocide against Muslims in the state. The Islamophobia generated all over the world by the September 11th, 2001 attacks put wind in their sails. The machinery of the Gujarat state stood by and watched while more than 2,000 people were massacred. Women were gang raped and burned alive. 150,000 Muslims were driven from their homes. The community was and continues to be ghettoized, socially and economically ostracized. Gujarat has always been a communally tense state. There have been riots before, but this was not a riot. It was a genocidal massacre. And though the number of victims was insignificant compared to the horrors of, say, Rwanda, Sudan, or the Congo, the Gujarat carnage was designed as a public spectacle whose aims were unmistakable. It was a public warning to Muslim citizens from the government of the world's favorite democracy. After the carnage, Narendra Modi pressed for early elections, and he was returned to power with a mandate from the people of Gujarat. 5 years later, he repeated his success, and he is now serving a third term as chief minister, widely appreciated across the country for his clear thinking and his faith in the free market. In January 2009, the relationship between fascism and the free market was sealed with a kiss at a public function. The CEOs of two of India's biggest corporations, Ratan Tata of the Tata Group and Mukesh Ambani of Reliance Industries, they must be among the, you know, world's biggest billionaires now on whatever, Forbes list or something, while accepting the Gujarat Garima, Pride of Gujarat Award, celebrated the development policies of Narendra Modi, architect of the Gujarat genocide, and warmly endorsed him as candidate for Prime Minister. But in May 2009, the nearly $2 billion general elections was concluded. And imagine that it cost, the Indian elections cost much more than the US elections. According to some media reports, the actual amount that was spent is closer to $10 billion. Where might one ask, does that kind of money come from? Basically, it comes from the bauxite mountains and the iron ore in the forests, which is where Operation Green Hunt is being fought now. Just the iron ore in Orissa is valued at $2 trillion. So the private corporations that have memorandums of understanding to mine, they pay the government a royalty of less than 7%. So you can imagine the kind of money that's floating around. The Congress and its allies, the United Progressive Alliance, UPA, have won a comfortable majority. Interestingly, more than 90% of the independent candidates who stood for elections lost. Clearly, without sponsorship, it's hard to win an election. And independent candidates cannot promise subsidized rice, free TVs, and cash for votes, those demeaning acts of vulgar charity that elections have been reduced to. When you take a closer look at the calculus that underlies elections, words like comfortable and majority turn out to be deceptive, if not outright inaccurate. For instance, the actual share of votes polled by the UPA in these elections works out to only 10.3% of the country's population. It's interesting how the cleverly layered mathematics of electoral democracy can turn a tiny minority into a thumping mandate. Anyway, be that as it may, the point is that it will not be L.K. Advani, hate monger incarnate, but Dr. Manmohan Singh, gentle architect of the market reforms, a man who has never won an election in his life, who will be prime minister of the world's largest democracy for a second term. And this is a fact, that he's never, ever won an election in his life. He just appointed. In the run-up to the polls, there was absolute consensus across party lines about the economic reforms. In some states, like Chhattisgarh, for example, where Operation Green Hunt is being fought, the BJP runs the government, and the Congress politicians run the Salva Judum, a vicious government-backed people's militia. The Judum and the government have formed a joint front against the Maoists in the forest, who are engaged in a deadly, brutal armed struggle against displacement and against land acquisition by corporations waiting to set up steel factories and to begin mining iron ore, tin, and all the other wealth stashed below the forest floor. So in Chhattisgarh, we have the remarkable spectacle of the two biggest political parties in India in an alliance against the Adivasis of Dantewada, India's poorest and most vulnerable people. Already 644 villages have been emptied. 50,000 people have been moved into Salva Judum camps, and 300,000 are hiding in the forests and are being called Maoist terrorists or sympathizers. The battle is raging and the corporations are waiting. It's significant that India is one of the countries that blocked a European move in the UN asking for an international probe into war crimes that may have been committed by the government of Sri Lanka in its recent offensive against the Tamil Tigers. Governments in this part of the world have taken note of Israel's Gaza blueprint as a good way of dealing with terrorism. Keep the media out and close in for the kill. That way they don't have to worry too much about who's a terrorist and who isn't. There may be a little flurry of international outrage, but it goes away pretty quickly. Things do not augur well for the forest-dwelling people of Chhattisgarh. But reinforced and reassured by the sort of constructive collaboration between political parties, few were more enthusiastic about the elections than some of the major corporate houses. They seem to have realized that a democratic mandate can legitimize their pillaging in a way that nothing else can. Several corporations ran extravagant advertising campaigns on TV, some featuring Bollywood film stars, urging people, young and old, rich and poor, to go out and vote. The media also started something new. They started selling packages, small, medium, large, to political parties, not advertising, but news, selling news, that we'll give you good coverage, but for a price. You know, so a political party could just go and buy a few editorials or buy coverage on TV. Shops and restaurants in Khan Market, Delhi's most Tony market, offered discounts to those whose index fingers were marked with the indelible ink to say that you had voted. Democracy suddenly became the cool new way to be. You know how it is. The Chinese do sport, so they had the Olympics. India does democracy, so we had an election. Both are heavily sponsored TV-friendly spectator sports. The BBC commissioned a coach on a train, the India election special, that took journalists from all over the world on a sightseeing tour to witness the miracle of Indian elections. The train coach had a slogan painted on it: "Will India's voters revive the world's fortunes?" BBC Hindi had a poster up in a cafe near my home. It featured a $100 bill with Ben Franklin morphing into a 500 rupee note with Gandhi. And it said, "Kya India ka vote bachayega dunya ka note?" Will India's votes rescue the world's currency notes? In these flagrant and unabashed ways, an electorate has been turned into a market. Voters are seen as consumers, and democracy is being welded to the free market. Those who cannot consume do not matter. What does the victory of the UPA mean in this election? Obviously, myriad things. The debate is wide open. Interpreting an Indian election is about as exact a science as sorcery. Voting patterns are intricately connected with local issues and caste and community equations that vary literally from polling booth to polling booth. There can be no reliable big conclusion. But here's something to think about. In its time in office, in order to mitigate the devastation caused by its economic policies, the former Congress regime passed three progressive, critics call them populist and controversial, parliamentary acts: the Forest Right Act, the Right to Information Act, and most important, the National Rural Employment Guarantee Act, the NREGA. The NREGA guarantees every rural family 100 days of work, hard manual labor, a year at minimum wages. It amounts to an average of 8,000 rupees, a little more than $120 per family per year, enough for a good meal in a restaurant, including wine and dessert. Imagine how hellish times must be for even that tiny amount of money to come as a relief to millions of people who are reeling under the impact of the precipitous loss of their lands and their livelihoods. Talk about crumbs from the high table. But then, which of us has the heart or the right to argue that no crumbs are better than crumbs, or indeed that no elections are better than meaningless elections? Implementing the NREGA and seeing that the crumbs actually reach the people they are meant for has occupied all the time and energy of some of India's finest and most committed social activists for the last several years. They've had to battle cartels of corrupt government officers, power brokers, and middlemen. They faced threats and a fair amount of violence. One rural activist in Jharkhand immolated himself in anger and frustration at the injustice of it all. But there's no doubt that the goodwill of the NREGA generated, that the NREG generated, translated into votes from the poor for the Congress. But now that the elections are over, the victory has been attributed to the very policies that the NREGA was passed to mitigate. The captains of industry have lost no time in claiming the people's mandate as their own. It's fast forward for the markets, the business papers crowed the morning after. Vote was for reforms, says India Incorporated. But for the sake of argument, let's for a moment contemplate the absurd and accept that India Inc. and the captains of industry are right, and that India's millions did in fact vote for the speeding up of market reforms. Is that good news or bad news? Should we be celebrating the fact that millions of people who have something to teach the world, who have another imagination, another worldview, and a more sustainable way of life, have decided to embrace a discredited ideology, one that has pushed this planet into a crisis from which it may never recover? What good will forest rights be when there are no forests? What good will the right to information be if there is no redress for our grievances? What good are rivers without water? What good are plains without mountains to water and sustain them? It's as though we are hurtling down a cliff in a bus without brakes and fighting over what songs to sing. For better or for worse, the 2009 elections seem to have ensured that the Progress Project in India is up and running. However, it would be a serious mistake to believe that the Union Project has fallen by the wayside. Whether it's the nuclear tests, the unsealing of the locks of the Babri Masjid, the culture of creating fissures and pitting castes and communities against each other, or passing retrograde laws, the Congress got there first and has never been shy of keeping the ball in play. In the past, both parties have used massacres to gain political mileage. Sometimes they feast off them obliquely. Sometimes they accuse each other of committing mass murder. In this election, both the Congress and the BJP brazenly fielded candidates believed to be involved in public lynchings and mass murder. At no point has either seen to it that the guilty are punished or that justice is delivered. Despite their vicious public exchange of accusations, they have colluded to protect one another from real consequences. The hoary institutions of Indian democracy, the judiciary, the police, the free press, and of course, elections, far from working as a system of checks and balances, often do the opposite. They provide each other cover to promote the larger interests of union and progress. And in the process, they generate such confusion, such a cacophony, that voices raised in warning just become part of the noise. And that only helps to enhance the image of the tolerant, lumbering, colorful, somewhat chaotic democracy. The chaos is real, but so is the consensus. And speaking of consensus, there's the small and ever-present matter of Kashmir. When it comes to Kashmir, the consensus in India is hardcore. It cuts across every section of the establishment, including the media, the bureaucracy, the intelligentsia, and even Bollywood. The war in the Kashmir Valley is almost 20 years old now and has claimed about 70,000 lives. Tens of thousands have been tortured. Several thousand have disappeared. Women have been raped. Tens of thousands widowed. 500,000 Indian troops patrol the Kashmir Valley, making it the most militarized zone in the world. The United States had about 165,000 active duty troops in Iraq at the height of its occupation. The Indian Army now claims that it has, for the most part, crushed militancy in Kashmir. Perhaps that's true, but does military domination mean victory? How does a government that claims to be a democracy justify a military occupation? By holding regular elections, of course. Elections in Kashmir have had a long and fascinating past. The blatantly rigged state elections of 1987 was the immediate provocation for the armed uprising that began in 1990. Since then, elections have become a finely honed instrument of the military occupation, a sinister playground for India's deep state. Intelligence agencies have created political parties and decoy politicians. They have constructed and destroyed political careers at will. It is they more than anyone else who decide what the outcome of each election will be. After every election, the Indian establishment declares that India has won a popular mandate from the people of Kashmir. In the summer of 2008, a dispute over land being allotted to the Amarnath Shrine Board coalesced into a massive non-violent uprising in Kashmir. Day after day, hundreds of thousands of people defied soldiers and policemen who fired straight into the crowds, killing scores of people, and thronged the streets. From early morning to late at night, the city reverberated to chants of Azadi, Azadi, freedom, freedom. Fruit sellers weighed fruit chanting Azadi, Azadi. Shopkeepers, doctors, houseboat owners, guides, weavers, carpet sellers, everybody was out with a placard. One had a placard which said, democracy without justice equals demon crazy. The protests went on for several days. They were massive, they were democratic, and they were nonviolent. For the first time in decades, fissures appeared in mainstream public opinion in India. The Indian state panicked. Unsure of how to deal with this mass civil disobedience, it ordered a crackdown. It enforced the harshest curfew in recent memory with shoot-on-sight orders. In effect, for days on end, it virtually caged millions of people. The major pro-freedom leaders were placed under house arrest. Several others were jailed. House-to-house searches culminated in the arrest of hundreds of people. The Jama Masjid was closed for Friday prayers for an unprecedented 7 weeks at a stretch. Once the rebellion was brought under control, the government did something extraordinary. It announced elections in the state. Pro-independence leaders called for a boycott. They were rearrested. Almost everybody believed that the elections would be a huge embarrassment for the Indian government. The security establishment was convulsed with paranoia. Its elaborate network of spies, renegades, and embedded journalists began to buzz with renewed energy. No chances were taken. Even I, who had nothing to do with any of what was going on, was put under house arrest in Srinagar for 2 days. Calling for the elections was a huge risk. But the gamble paid off. People turned out to vote in droves. It was the biggest voter turnout since the armed struggle began. It helped that the polls were scheduled so that the first districts to vote were the most militarized districts, even within the Kashmir Valley. None of India's analysts, journalists, and sephologists cared to ask why people who had only weeks ago risked everything, including bullets and shoot-on-sight orders, should have suddenly changed their minds. None of the high-profile scholars of the great festival of democracy, who practically live in TV studios when there are elections in mainland India, picking apart every forecast and exit poll and every minor percentile swing in the vote count, talked about what elections mean in the presence of such a massive year-round troop deployment, an armed soldier for every 20 civilians. No one speculated about the mystery of hundreds of unknown candidates who materialized out of nowhere to represent political parties that had no previous presence in the Kashmir Valley. Where had they come from? Who was financing them? No one was curious. No one spoke about the curfew, the mass arrests, the lockdown of constituencies that were going to the polls. Nor many talked about the fact that campaigning politicians went out of their way to de-link Azadi and the Kashmir dispute from elections, which they insisted were only about municipal issues, roads, water, electricity. No one talked about why people who have lived under a military occupation for decades, where soldiers could barge into homes and whisk away people at any time of the day or night, might need someone to listen to them, to take up their cases, to represent them. The minute the elections were over, the establishment and the mainstream press declared victory for India once again. The most worrying fallout was that in Kashmir, people began to parrot their colonizers' view of themselves as a somewhat pathetic people who deserved what they got. "Never trust a Kashmiri," several Kashmiris said to me. "We are fickle and unreliable." Psychological warfare, technically known as PSYOPs, has been an instrument of official policy in Kashmir, and its depredations over decades, its attempt to destroy people's self-esteem, are arguably the worst aspects of the occupation. It's enough to make you wonder whether there's any connection at all between elections and democracy. The trouble is that Kashmir sits on the fault lines of a region that is awash in weapons and sliding into chaos. The Kashmiri freedom struggle, with its crystal clear sentiment but fuzzy outlines, is caught in the vortex of several dangerous and conflicting ideologies: Indian nationalism, corporate as well as Hindu; Pakistani nationalism, breaking down under the burden of its own contradictions; U.S. imperialism, made impatient by a tanking economy; and a resurgent medieval Islamist Taliban, fast gaining legitimacy despite its insane brutality, because it seemed to be resisting an occupation. Each of these ideologies is capable of a ruthless that can range from genocide to nuclear war. Add Chinese imperial ambitions, an aggressive reincarnated Russia, and the huge reserves of natural gas in the Caspian region, and persistent whispers about natural gas, oil, and uranium reserves in Kashmir and Ladakh, and you have the recipe for a new Cold War, which, like the last one, is cold for some and hot for others. In the midst of all this, Kashmir is said to be the conduit through which the mayhem unfolding in Afghanistan and Pakistan spills into India, where it will find purchase in the anger of the young among India's 150 million Muslims who've been brutalized, humiliated, and marginalized. Notice has been given by the series of terrorist strikes that culminated in the Mumbai attacks of 2008. There's no doubt that the Kashmir dispute ranks right up there, along with Palestine, as one of the oldest, most intractable disputes in the world. That doesn't mean it can't be solved, but we haven't even reached the stage where the government of India is prepared to admit there's a problem, let alone negotiate a solution. Right now, it has no reason to. Internationally, its stocks are soaring, and while its neighbors deal with bloodshed, civil war, concentration camps, refugees, and army mutinies, India has just concluded a beautiful election. However, demon crazy cannot fool all the people all the time. Thank you.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
All right, the conversation part of the buffet this evening. Thank you for that reading.
You're welcome.
So I don't know whether everyone here subscribes to Outlook magazine. Probably a little hard to get. This issue has this extraordinary 20,000-word essay that Arundhati has just written in the last month. Yeah?
Well, 2 days before I came here.
2 days before she came, she was finishing it. It's her walk in the forests with the Maoist insurgency. and I exhort you to go and read it, or if a publisher is shortly to publish it, to buy it. And we need to talk about this, because this is your latest work, and it's an extraordinary piece. Exclusive 32-page essay. I wish we could just have a reading party first. First of all, what was... I guess we have to lay a little bit of the landscape. You described a little bit about the economic stakes in the Civil War. Most of the reporting that we get, those of us who go the extra distance to get some international news, understand that there's some sort of civil war going on with the Maoist insurgency. We remember that your prime minister called it the gravest internal security threat to India the year before last,
year. In 2005.
And the stakes are getting higher. You've been writing about this movement for a while. You've been vilified for doing so. And now you've just spent 2 weeks walking with an invisible army in the forest. So what was it like?
Well, basically, I think what's interesting is that if you look at what's going on in that part of the world, starting in Afghanistan to Waziristan to the northwest frontier provinces, through the northeast of India to West Bengal, Jharkhand, Orissa, what you're seeing is a tribal uprising. Sometimes it takes on the face of radical Islam, and here it's basically radical communism. But the assault on tribal lands is a corporate, imperial corporate assault, you know? So that's quite interesting. And in India, these states are known as the Red Corridor in the press.
It's extraordinary reading some of the stuff, the red-baiting language that exists in the official discourse in India today.
It's just crazy. And though the Maoist movement in different shapes and forms, you know, first started in 1967 in India, and it's always been wiped out, exterminated, it comes back, and so on. But it's in this tribal area. Some of us call it the MOUist corridor, not the red, the Maoist corridor, the MOU as in the Memorandum of Understanding corridor. Because if you look at a map of India, the forests, the minerals, the indigenous people, and the Maoist movement are all stacked up on top of each other.
But at the moment, these memoranda are their corporate contracts. We don't know what's in them because they're secret, but they haven't gone into, to what extent have they gone into effect? To what extent
is
extraction taking place?
Well, this is what is extraordinary. You know, in 2005, billions of dollars worth of MOUs were signed for bauxite, for iron ore, and so on. And at that time, the Prime Minister suddenly says, Maoists are the gravest internal security threat in India, at a time when they were certainly not a security threat. In fact, they had just been wiped out of Andhra Pradesh. They had lost some 1,600 of their cadre. So it was an odd thing to say. But the stocks of these mining companies went soaring in the stock market because they realized that the Prime Minister was now signaling that he was going to go in. And there were, you know, the Tata signed a big contract for an integrated steel plant.
This is the big steel conglomerate.
The big steel conglomerate, and another company called SR. And so it was interesting that 2005 the MOUs were signed. 2005 this People's Militia was formed. 2005 the Prime Minister makes a statement. 2005. A jungle warfare training school starts, and now they're planning to have 20 of them or something in India.
These are the paramilitaries going after the Maoists.
Yeah, and of course the People's Militia. It started off with a sort of Vietnam-style, you know, strategic hamleting, which was to go in and burn villages and make people move out into police camps. And if you didn't move out, then you were a Maoist. So, in fact, what happened is that for tribal people in the forest, just living at home is a dangerous terrorist activity. So now they're all living in the forest, scared to come back to their villages. And
So we need to get to your actual experience, but let's lay a little bit more ground. There is a Maoist insurgency, which is connected to movements in the 60s and 70s that has been moving from state to state as in some ways landed here. But there's also an indigenous population, the tribals or the Adivasi people, who have also been resisting in different ways the Indian state for many more decades. So explain, if you can, the intersection between these separate movements which are co-inhabiting the struggle.
Well, actually, they've always been, the Maoist movement has always been mostly in tribal areas. And of course, the tribal people in India have a history of resistance that predates Mao by some centuries. You know, so there is a coincidence of these two things. But basically, right now, I would say that in the area where I visited, 99.9% of the, or more, I mean, almost 100% of this, the guerrilla army are indigenous people. And of them, the fascinating thing is that 45% of the armed cadre are women. So it was, I went in with some of my own prejudices about, you know, that women are the victims of armed struggle and so on.
Left-wing movements being doctrinaire and patriarchal?
Mm.
Where would you get that?
It's true.
Weird.
But
and then you've found some extraordinary women. So, but to be clear, this is a movement whose you know, chief spokespeople speak in clear terms about a violent overthrow of the Indian state in very stultified, classic left doctrine,
language,
which shares a lot with Stalinism. Right, the way they talk?
Yeah, the ideologues can be Stalinist.
And they kill people?
They kill people, but they don't kill people in some senseless, crazy way as is made out, you know, because they now what's happening is there are these huge paramilitary camps and police go in groups of 300 or 1,000, surround a village, burn it, rape the women. You know, and so, and they're trying to do what they call creeping reoccupation. So, in fact, a lot of the, I mean, I don't know when there's a war like that on. Obviously, the Indian media tries to make out that the Maoists are some crazy bunch of people who just go around killing. It's not the case, you know, at least not from my understanding of what's going on there at all.
So we need to share a little bit of your experience of these 2 weeks of walking through the forest. It starts with a note slipped under your door.
Yeah, it started with a note. I actually been waiting. I had, you know, been called through someone, and asked whether I would be prepared to go into the forest, you know, for some weeks. So I said, sure. Because there's so many lies and there's so much subterfuge and, you know, half the newspapers and TV channels have mining interests and so you just don't know what's true, what's not true. And so I...
And I guess even as someone who has been trying to introduce a more nuanced view of this insurgency for a decade at least,
yeah,
you still hadn't spent time among its members.
No, I mean, you can't spend time amongst members because they are all in the forest. And it's, and I was, you know, I mean, the decade has also for me been a decade where I've watched the great Gandhian nonviolent movements just being humiliated and kicked out, you know. Every single institution that they approached had humiliated them. All those dams were going up. And, you know, more and more you could see as the economic policies were pushing in, India had to become a police state because you fundamental to doing these big infrastructural projects is pushing people off their land. So, you know, there was this kind of convulsion. And anyway, so I sort of indicated that I would be, you know, quite happy to go in. And then I just got this note saying, you know, giving me a place where I had to be on two consecutive days, four different timings. And it said, you know, writer shall have a copy of the Hindi Outlook magazine and a red T tikka and
folded up newspaper and a trench coat.
Yeah, so I was like, okay, and the password was going to be Namaskar Guruji. So I thought maybe they were expecting a man, you know, and should I get a mustache? And then I was there, and it was very sweet because my first encounter was with the gravest internal security threat was this little kid who came up to me with like red nail polish, and he was supposed to have a outlook and a banana and so on. I said, Namaskar Guruji. And he just came to me and said, you want to go in? I said, hey, what? Then I said, what about,
he said, where's the banana, dude?
Where's the banana? He said, I'm very hungry, I ate it. Then he gave me a little note saying, outlook nahi mila, meaning we couldn't find an outlook. And so I went with him. And he had this little backpack.
Reality just doesn't disappoint.
Yeah. He had this little backpack which said, Charlie Brown, not your ordinary blockhead. And I mean, that's how I started my walk into the forest. It was just the most amazing experience. I mean, walking for nights and nights and nights and weeks, two and a half weeks I was there, sleeping outdoor. I mean,
so you were in their underground bunkers with the sophisticated security systems, the heat-seeking missiles, and
they're buying from Mossad.
Right.
I wish I could show you pictures, you know, of what it was like, but anyway.
So what is the situation for the people with whom you walked, and to what extent did you feel that you got an unfiltered, an unsculptured look at what their reality is?
Well, you know, the thing is that we walked so much and through so many villages, and I'm not, I'm not somebody who hasn't been through villages and things before, I know how to read the signs, you know, and the smiles and the, you know, walking through paths where you meet bunches of little kids, you know, everyone saying Lal Salam, red salute, you know. They can control it in such a large area and so mm-hmm. on.
And you're just walking.
And you're camping never more than a night in a place, and sometimes only a few hours. Sometimes you're like, have dinner, go to sleep. Sorry, you got to walk now. We can't stay. It's not safe.
To what extent did it feel dangerous, like a war zone? Did you see any action? Was there a sense that that violence could erupt?
Look, I had been to there's a river called the Indravati, and when you cross that river, the police call it Pakistan.
Right.
And they say that I had been there before, not gone into the forest, but into the, you know, the outside, and the police, I had met this superintendent of police who told me that when you cross the river, we shoot to kill. And I heard a recording of a former superintendent of police instructing his men how to burn every village that doesn't surrender, and to kill any journalist who goes to cover the area. You know, so when you're right inside, you're less worried, but when you're near the, what they call the border, then it's worrying. And every day you're getting news of people who are being killed, and I met a lot of families who had lost family members who had been killed by the police or by the Salvajurum.
So this piece came out, you know, in a major Indian magazine. It came out 2 days ago. Mm. And the cover has you with a bunch of rebels, and the title is Walking with the Comrades. In it, you describe them as a true people's army. You speak at the end in, I think, fairly, don't take this the wrong way, but fairly romantic terms about some of the young women that you met and the hope that that you see in them for creating some sort of alternative society, you must be getting hammered for this.
Well, look, I'll tell you what it was. I mean, it wasn't the hope of an alternative society for the whole world. It was an alternative to their own annihilation. You know, it was people who are standing up and fighting and saying, we're not going to move, you know, and we're not going to buy into your morality. And a lot of the women that I met, what I found remarkable was that many of them had joined after having watched their villages burn, after having watched their comrades or friends, actually having watched them being raped and killed, because this movement has predated this whole mining thing by 30 years, you know. So for 30 years, they've been walking in the forests and working in the forests. And there's literally, it's like there's 90,000 members of the Krantikari Adivasi Mahila Sangathan, which is the revolutionary women's movement. I mean, those are straight down 90,000 Maoists. Are you going to kill them all, you know? Is the government going to kill them? So a lot of the women had joined even to get away from the traditional patriarchy of their own society. You know, so that's what's nice about it, that it's not romantic. Oh, look at these wonderful tribal people. Everything they do must be right.
Beautiful. You know, and yes, in harmony with
no, earth. It's something that's alive and there, you know. And to see that they are fighting to not be annihilated, because that's what's, that, you know, they've laid siege to the forest. It's not that they're going to go in and kill everybody, but the problem is that the markets are full of informers. People can't go out. People can't go to their villages. As it is, it's a population that's living on the brink of starvation. Mm-hmm. So,
they had one doctor that you saw.
They had one doctor who had been, I mean, they had never had a doctor for so many years. Now they had one doctor, you know.
And the medical situation was,
the medical situation is dire. They can't go to the market and buy provisions because they're told that, oh, you're feeding the Maoists. You know, so.
Now, I know that this story is, you don't like to make the story about you, but I need to ask you about what it's like for you in this moment. I just want to convey for the audience a little bit of the environment in which you live. I found a short piece from 2 weeks ago in the Economic Times, which I assume is a important, fancy, reputable Indian newspaper. And this was when the Maoist leader had suggested that there might be a ceasefire if you and some other intellectuals in India would serve as mediators, a role that you quite sensibly rejected, being, as you said, unqualified.
Yeah.
But this was how it was described in a major Indian newspaper. Maoist leader Kishenji has named renowned cop basher, a regular at the capital's grievance-mongering seminars, Arundhati Roy, and rebel Trinamool Congress leader Kabir Suman, who flaunts his sympathy for the Red Menace, as possible mediators for talks with the government. The government is sure to reject this offer, as the two names suggested by the Maoist leaders share a wacky state-is-an-oppressor prejudice. The two police-loathing personalities have been routinely bombarding the media with deep thoughts and cherry-picked data to paint the police and the establishment as real culprits. So this is a fairly mild
yeah,
description
mild.
Of
normally
of you
it's
India.
Like hang Arundhati Roy,
right.
Send her out of the country.
So, but seriously, this major piece in a major magazine, which is being presented with all of that legitimacy, is going to be a marker in the public understanding of this struggle and of the ability of the state to dehumanize this resistance. And you've put yourself out there once again. So what has it been like so far?
Well,
and what are
I
what
think
are, what
I did a wise
like?
Thing by leaving before
right, exactly.
It was published.
Publish and depart.
Publish and depart. No, actually, there's one thing that we should talk about is what's going on with the Indian media. It's really, I mean, it's like Fox News on steroids, you know? Some of the channels. It's really Fox on Coke. I mean,
it's more Coke than steroids.
Yeah,
I think you're
yeah.
Right.
like there are, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with the term encounter, but in India it's a very common word where the police kill X in an encounter. You're allowed to kill Muslims and you're allowed to kill Maoists in encounters. And you have encounter specialists. And the more people they kill, the more rewards they get, the more bravery awards and all of that, you know. And there have been so many incidents of, completely fake encounters, but there are no questions asked. You can just go and kill. So if you ask a question, then you're a cop basher. You know, how dare you question the police? Like the police are always right, you know? And unfortunately, for example, in Kashmir a few years ago, a family received an anonymous note from an army officer saying that your son has been killed and has been buried as an Afghan militant in Kupwara, which is a border town in Kashmir. And actually it turned out that these four laborers who had gone to Kupwara to do some fencing work or something for the army had been killed and called militants, because then you get promotions, you get rewards and so on. And this whole thing was...
So you put a uniform on them after they're dead.
Yeah, yeah.
In Colombia, they call it false positives.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Phenomenon. In fact, this happens all the time. In this essay, so many of the villagers told me, you know, the police, they come and they always bring uniforms so that whoever they kill, they put uniforms on and then they can get, rewards for. But this is happening, meaning all the time there. And... If you ask these questions, like when the Mumbai attack happened, just before that, there had been a encounter in Delhi where they had gone in and killed some four Muslim students, and some of us had raised questions about it. And during the Mumbai attacks, on the Fox News on Coke channel, there's a policeman who was being interviewed, and he said, "Now will you call Arundhati Roy and... you know, she'll come and criticize the police, and if it wasn't for us, you know, how would you manage her," and so on. And so the news reader looks at the TV and says, "Arundhati Roy, I hope you're watching this. We think you're disgusting." It's like... But on the other hand, you know, you have to understand that this is such a small section, very powerful people, but a very, very small section of people. And the rest of it, it's completely the other way around. You know, on the last night in the forest, the only communication you have, obviously, is the radio. And there was a BBC Hindi radio program we were listening to on the Naxal, on the Maoist issue. And the presenter kept saying 85% of the people calling in were supporting them. You know?
And there was a brief period when they were legalized.
It keeps happening.
Some years ago. Comes and goes,
yeah.
And they turn out a lot of people when they have rallies.
Yeah, huge.
So we're going to end this evening with Arundhati's going to do another short reading. But before we do that, there's a couple of other quick things I'd like to cover. Last year I read an interview with you in which you said that you resented the idea that the whole world has to be interested in American elections. which as a Canadian who was covering the elections at the time, I felt a great kinship. And I'm delighted to have spent an entire evening in a non-self-reflexive examination of the politics of this country, no matter how vital they are to what happens in the world. But I did feel reading the book, and I do feel reading your work of the last few years, that there are some astonishing parallels between these two great democracies, with all the quotation marks required. And I want to just tease a couple of them out here at the end where it's safe. We haven't put it up front. The need, as people fall through the gaping cracks, as an economic model leaves the vast majority of a country's people behind. And in the United States, the last two bubbles were marked really by the leaving behind of the middle class and the descent of the middle class in huge parts of it into poverty in this country. And now we have official statistics that verify what was the truth for a majority of people in this country for the last couple of decades, increasingly. And it almost seems that the natural anger of those people for the betrayal of the middle class promise that was made to them has got to go somewhere. And the exploitation of that anger and the rise of ugliness in political discourse, in media, whatever drug they're doing, whatever channel space they occupy, is characteristic of this moment. What if, in your study of India and the lumbering of the democratic institutions, in some cases, you argue towards fascism, what have you learned that you think that this country needs to look out for? Or what do you sense in the two situations which might actually lead us to some productive way of responding?
I think there are, as you say, these parallels, but the the difference is that in America, even while huge sections of the population fall out of the basket, they're still in the system, you know? I mean, in India, the difference is that such a lot of people are just, they've never been a part of the system, like the tribal people. I mean, the state has never done anything for them. They don't have numbers or addresses or car, you know?
They don't exist for the state.
They don't exist, and in a way, that gives the resistance a whole new dimension, you know? The possibility of the imagination, you know, the imagination is different there. So one of the reasons that I think I was so interested in what was happening here is not because these people are going to be able to put up to the world an alternative for the whole world, but what they are saying, and I am with them on this, is that you can't have the river water from our rivers, you can't have the bauxite from our mountain, you can't have the iron ore from the forest floor. Now you make do with what you have. And once in the world of the free market, once you have to accommodate that, somebody saying enough, there is a domino effect, you know, and people will have to find alternatives to the endless rampaging through other people's ecologies and other people's wealth and other people's freedoms, you know. So right now the difference between India and America is that even though there are a huge number of poor Americans, still this economy is preying on economies outside the borders. Mm-hmm. Whereas in India, it's colonized itself. You know, so it's making war on its own people. Mm-hmm. It's been doing that since the moment it became a sovereign power.
There was a smooth transition there.
Yeah, like from 1947 onwards, it's made war in Nagaland, Manipur, Kashmir, Assam, Telangana, Goa, Punjab. You know, it's just been protracted war.
When you read to us some of the doctrine of the Hindu nationalists, and you compare it to some of the talk in this country, it's not a small thing. The biggest talk show in America that dwarfs all of its competitors by millions of viewers. The host speaks regularly of progressivism as a cancer. And we know that when you get into the medical metaphors, you're talking about eradication.
Yeah.
You're talking about vermin.
Yeah.
You're using language that you have been identifying for a decade or more in the rise of a type of fascism in India. And the Tea Party movement, which has exploded in the last week in this country in some more ugly incidents of types that we've seen, of racism, of homophobia in the halls of Congress. I don't think there's any comparison in the levels of virulence, of violence, of the human toll. But there are people who are dispossessed, who are not completely off the radar, who are angry, who are being used, and whose anger is being channeled
it'll be very frightening. I mean, this is true in India too, that eventually there are so many subcutaneous levels of unhappiness, right? I mean, as we know, the Taliban is now a radical Islamist uprising, but it is fighting an occupation, you know. Similarly in India, like if you look at the killing of Christians in Orissa, actually behind that whole thing, there's a bauxite mountain. And the problem is that when you start destroying movements like this, which at least speak the language of justice, you end up with completely lumpenized, criminalized, reactionary politics, which I think you could see here too, very, 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 very soon, you know. And the causes will be what our analysis says it is, but the manifestation will be terrible. And I don't know how, I don't know how that process can be reversed, because I don't think that the alternative can come from the imagination that created the problem in the first place. You know, it'll have to come from people who have been left out of this.
Who are free to dream something
better. and who will resist it because they don't have a choice. I find this really shocking that people who are middle class, I find it so easy to stop hoping, whereas people who have nothing don't have an option, you know, so they do not give up hope.
And to whom did you dedicate this book?
Yeah, this book is dedicated to those who know how to divorce hope from reason.
I'll clap for that. Why don't you sanctify the divorce with the final reading?
Okay, I'll just read for a minute. Perhaps the story of the Siachen Glacier, the highest battlefield in the world, is the most appropriate metaphor for the insanity of our times. Thousands of Indian and Pakistani soldiers have been deployed there, enduring chill winds and temperatures that dip to minus 40 degrees Celsius. Of the hundreds who've died there, many have died from the cold, from frostbite and sunburn. The glacier has become a garbage dump now, littered with the detritus of war. Thousands of empty artillery shells, empty fuel drums, ice axes, old boots, tents, and every other kind of waste that thousands of warring human beings generate. The garbage remains intact, perfectly preserved at those icy temperatures, a pristine monument to human folly. While the Indian and Pakistani governments spent billions of dollars on weapons and the logistics of high-altitude warfare, the battlefield has begun to melt. Right now, it has shrunk to about half its size. The melting has less to do with the military standoff than with people far away on the other side of the world living the good life. They are good people who believe in peace and free speech and in human rights. They live in thriving democracies whose governments sit on the UN Security Council and whose economies depend heavily on the export of war and the sale of weapons to countries like India and Pakistan and Rwanda, Sudan, Somalia, the Republic of Congo, Iraq, Afghanistan. It's a long list. The glacial melt will cause severe floods in the subcontinent and eventually severe drought that will affect the lives of millions of people. And that will give us even more reasons to fight. We'll need more weapons. Who knows, that sort of consumer confidence may be just what the world needs to get over the current recession. Then everyone in the thriving democracies will have an even better life, and the glaciers will melt even faster. While I read, listening to grasshoppers to a tense audience packed into a university auditorium in Istanbul. Tense because words like unity, progress, genocide, and Armenian tend to anger the Turkish authorities when they are uttered close together. But I could see Raquel Dink, Harant Dink's widow, sitting in the front row, crying the whole way through. When I finished, she hugged me and said, "We keep hoping. Why do we keep hoping?" "We," she said, "not you." The words of Fez, Ahmed Fez, sung so hauntingly by Abida Parveen, came to me. "Nahi nigah me manzil to justuju hi sahi, nahi visal mayasar to arzu hi sahi." I tried to translate them for her, sort of. If dreams are thwarted, then yearning must take their place. If reunion is impossible, then longing must take its place. You see what I meant about poetry.
Thank you. Thank you.
Listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.